escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at OCOcean.com.
I don't know about you, but whenever I find myself feeling excessively angry at my political opponents, I like to ask myself, what would Jesus do? Then, since I can't hit them with a lightning bolt and fling them reeling into hell for all eternity, I try instead to understand where they're coming from and whether I can get them to go back there and stay there and never show their ugly faces anywhere near me ever again. So today, in an effort to build bridges of understanding between Democrats and decent human beings, I'd like to take a sympathetic look at what the left believes. According to the left, critical race theory is not racism, and anyone who thinks it is just a white devil helplessly acting out the imperialist oppression that flows through his bloodstream, carrying the essential whiteness that is just a social construct but is impossible to change. According to the left, critical race theory is not being taught in schools and should continue to be taught in schools in every state, despite the fact that minority children are falling far behind in math and reading. Math and reading are just white concepts created to stop black people from becoming educated in traditional African ways that are completely imaginary and have nothing to do with the real Africa, where American black people haven't lived for more than 200 years, so they really need to learn math and reading instead of critical race theory, which is not being taught in schools and will continue to be. And what about transgenderism? According to the left, men and women are exactly the same, and some men even are women and are therefore totally different from men, while being exactly the same, except for wearing skirts and pretending to be women, who are very different. A person's identity, of course, is defined completely by their race and sexuality, because humans are totally physical beings and are therefore not at all defined by their physical being, but by a mystical inner soul that can identify as any race or gender it pleases. Thus, a human's completely physical existence is defined by his disembodied soul, which does not exist. Because if it did exist, he'd have to believe in God and stop doing the immoral stuff he's doing, and morality is relative. Because what's immoral here is totally immoral in another country like imaginary Africa and other places that don't exist, like the soul that totally defines us. Finally, it's very important that everyone receive free college where they won't learn math and reading because that would be white, but will instead be taught critical race theory, which is not being taught. Therefore, everyone must also receive a guaranteed income because they're now unemployable because they can't do math or read because that would be white. And critical race theory, which is not racist, hates whiteness. The free college and guaranteed income will, of course, be paid for with money taken from billionaires who earned it building businesses that they will no longer build, because what's the point if you're going to take all their money, which they now no longer have anyway? I hope this little journey into the mind of the left will help you understand what Democrats are trying to accomplish so you can reach out across the aisle and stop them and maybe punch them in the testicles while you're at it just to make sure they get the point. That would also probably answer the question, what would Jesus do? Trigger warning, I'm Andrew Klavan, and this is The Andrew Klavan Show.
I feel hunky-dunky, life is tickety-boo. Birds are winging, also singing, hunky-dunky-dee-doo. Ship-shaped, ipsy-topsy, the world is zippity-zing. It's a wonderful day, hurrah, hooray!
It makes me want to sing, oh, hurrah, hooray!
All right, we are back once again laughing our way through the fall of the Republic. And if you would like to keep laughing until the Republic just collapses on top of you, please go on Apple Podcasts and subscribe and give us a 5-star review. It's incredibly helpful to us. So do it just out of the goodness of your heart. Also, go on YouTube and subscribe to the Andrew Klavan YouTube channel. Don't do that out of the goodness of your heart, because if you ring that little bell, you'll start to hear a little tingling in your ear, and that will probably last until you get care from a doctor. Also, leave a comment, and if the comment is sufficiently ignorant, racist, sexist, and offensive, we will include it on today's show, because That's who we are. Today's comment comes from Ryan Hunter. He says, sometimes I wonder how it is that Klavan has such command over the English language. And then I remember that Klavan was actually there when English was invented. Then it makes sense. That's true. In fact, I actually worked on the language with several scientists who were inventing it at the time because Latin had just become, too difficult to understand. So I am finally in my house. And one of the things I am happiest to see there is my Helix mattress, because as you know, I do not sleep, but I do lie awake, and you want to be comfortable when you're lying awake. Even if you do sleep, a Helix mattress is the thing you want to sleep on. So go to helixsleep.com/Klavan and take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they will match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life, or in my case, the best lying awake. I took the quiz. I was matched to the Helix Midnight Lux, which is a medium firm mattress designed for side sleepers or for side lying awake. Helix mattresses have a 10-year warranty. They're made right in America, and you get to try them out for 100 nights risk-free. That will even pick yours up for you if you don't like it, but you will. Right now, Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders at helixsleep.com/Klavan. Get up to $200 off at helixsleep.com/Klavan. You too can lie awake and ask yourself, how do you spell Klavan? So true. So today I'm going to talk about the crisis of climate change. I'm joking. That would be ridiculous. I'm going to talk about Cuba. But first, I want to talk about the fact that I have finally moved into my house. I am now no longer homeless after weeks and weeks of wandering lonely as a cloud. I now have a home. And I want to say, first of all, the first thing I want to say is that if there were a Nobel Prize for homemakers, which as far as I'm concerned is the only profession that actually deserves a Nobel Prize, my wife would not only win the first one, it would be named after her. It would just be called the Ellen Prize. She has done a great job putting this house together in record time. She had help from some designers who I won't name because I don't know if that would damage their business being associated with me, but they were terrific. But she really did a great job running these crews. And now I want to talk for a minute about the idea of home, and especially in the idea of home in my life, because home has become more important to me as I grew older and came to terms with a lifelong wanderlust and what my wanderlust meant, what it meant in my life and what it meant kind of philosophically. Because I talk about this in my memoir, The Great Good Thing. I was always very moved and very captured by the romantic American idea of the drifter. I actually wanted to be a professional drifter. I mean, this is something that is very deep in the American consciousness. It's the symbol of freedom that's connected to the idea of a wilderness, a place where you can wander off into open country and disappear and be completely yourself with no one there to bother you. And so I grew up with that idea very much in my mind. I mean, Huckleberry Finn, who you remember at the end of the novel, he lights out into the territory, into the open countries, because he's just such a free spirit that nothing can contain him. My mother used to call me Huckleberry Fine, which was the Jewish version of Huckleberry Finn, because I just had that spirit of drifting in me. And there was all this kind of romantic music. I remember Ricky Nelson, who was a big rock star when I was a little kid. He has a song called Traveling Man. When I was working at a gas station to earn money to take my first of countless trips across country, which I did in my efforts to become a drifter, I was working at a gas station 11 hours a day, 6 days a week. I think I was paid $2 an hour, which was a lot of money. And if you were working 66 hours a week. And there was a song called So Far Away by Carole King. And the song used to just break my heart. And because they played one of those top 10 radio stations that was constantly playing the same songs over and over again, I would hear So Far Away all day long. And it just made me yearn to be on the open road. It was another one of these vagabond anthems. And today, not anymore, but for decades after that experience, whenever that song came on the radio, I would smell gasoline, because gasoline is very much connected to memory. Anyway, the idea of wandering, of drifting, became very popular again in the 60s when I was growing up, because that was when a generation was kind of yearning for that sense of freedom. They felt that they were constrained by 1950s culture. Obviously, conservatives look back on that culture with nostalgia, but it was very lockstep and very, kind of solidified. It was a solidified culture. And so people did feel oppressed by it. Women felt oppressed by it. Men felt oppressed by it. It was just kind of the idea of the man in the gray flannel suit, and there was not a lot of creativity. So a lot of the road romance came back into fashion when I was a kid, and it really caught me up in it. Jack Kerouac and his book On the Road became popular again. Easy Rider was another version of that. There was a show on that I just loved, a television show on. It only lasted for a year. It was called Then Came Bronson, where a guy, it was Michael Parks, who was a very James Dean-like actor, died a few years back, but he played a newspaper man whose friend killed himself, and so he got on a motorcycle and just took off into the territories like Huckleberry Finn. And this was the opening of the show. It was cut 25. This was how the show opened every week. It was Bronson on his motorcycle in a traffic jam, and the workaday guy looks out the window and he sees him there.
Taking a trip?
What's that?
Taking a trip.
Yeah.
Where to?
Oh, I don't know. Wherever I end up, I guess.
Well, I wish I was you.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, hang in there.
That show came on when I was 15 years old, and I just carried my heart away. And I spent years wandering around the country. I slept in hobo camps. I slept on the street. I was chased by police. I had many romantic adventures. A lot of fun to it, and it was something that really just every time I would look at a kind of vista of hills, I just wanted to take off and travel over that next hill. And I've remained a vagabond most of my life. I moved my family from the exurbs of New York to the city of New York to the city of London to Santa Barbara in California to Hollywood. And now I've moved them once again, or what's left of my family, which is my wife, back to the eastern seaboard. And yet, all of this time, I think what I've been trying to avoid, you saw it there, and then came Bronson. It was the conflict between the free American spirit. He's going to take that motorcycle and just disappear. And the guy, the ad for Then Came Bronson was Then Came Bronson, the man you wish you were. And that guy, that workaday guy stuck in traffic, has all the responsibilities, has the wife and the kids and the, maybe a church and the community. And he's hemmed in by his responsibilities. And the American spirit is always trying to reinvent itself and wants to take off. And I think I was trying to avoid getting locked into any way of life that would keep me from being the creative artist that I was. I always wanted to maintain my personality, my individualism. But over time, my sense that my core identity was more than individualism began to increase. And when I started doing this show, which is now, I don't know, 6 years, 7 years ago, when I first started doing the show, I would say I'm an individualist. And I remember about a year after I started doing the show, I was taking a walk in Oxford, England with my son, Spencer Clavin, no relation. And it was one of our kind of famous rambles when we would talk about philosophy and such. And I said to him, this individualism doesn't work. It's not enough to say that you're an individualist, because in fact, we depend on one another. We depend on our mothers when we're born, on our fathers, on our families. We define one another through our relationships with brothers and sons and friends. That's who we are. A part of who we are is who we are in relationship to other people. And that balance between the community that can become restrictive, like the guy in the car with Then Came Bronson, and that yearning to be completely individualistic and completely free, which is very American, that tension between those two things is very much what Western civilization is about. If you go back to the Reformation, which is so much the defining moment that creates the modern Western world, the Reformation is a way, this conflict between institutional Christianity and what was called the inner light Christianity, the individual interpretation Christianity. In many ways, Catholicism, which was Christianity in the West for a long time, taught individuality. It taught people to honor the individual because Jesus was an individual and each soul was infinitely worthwhile. And so it taught people the value of individuality. And there's a book called Inventing the Individual by a philosopher named Larry Seidentop. Really interesting book. And what Seidentop says is the Catholic Church invented individuality, the holiness, the sacredness of the individual. And that came back to bite them when the individual said, oh, well, then why do we need priests to read the Bible for us? Why do we need a church to tell us what to believe? Why can't each one of us read the Gospels for ourselves and decide what they mean? And so the Catholic Church invented individuality, and individuality came back and said, well, we now want to be free of the Catholic Church. And that's the tension that has continued in Western culture and continues to this day. In our political differences, we have the leftists who want the state to take care of us all and say, everything you do affects so many people, so we have to control what you do. You have to wear a mask because I might get sick. You have to, you know, pay for health care because I have to pay for your health care if you go to the emergency room. Everything is this big link. And then you have the right, which has this kind of, at its core, has this individualism, which can become sort of selfishness is the great virtue, the kind of Ayn Rand idea that if we're all just absolutely individualistic, then somehow that will raise all ships. And you know, there's also, but it works in the reverse order too. You know, obviously either one of those can become oppressive. It can become oppressive if the state is running everything, but it can also become oppressive if nobody cares about one another and we're just about profit and my own good. And I just go forward thinking about myself, that Ayn Rand idea I've always told you is like just really a psychopathic idea at its base. And so that either one taken to an extreme can become insanity. And in fact, there's an insane right-wing sense of communitarianism where you have the sort of, you know, nationalist blood and soil European right-wingism where everybody has to be kind of in lockstep and fascist lockstep. And then you have the individualism that goes too far on the left where you say, oh, you know, I have a right to kill my baby because I don't want to be a mother, you know, or I have the right to declare myself a woman, even if it infringes on the rights of actual real women. And so anytime you take any of these things to extreme, you become crazy. You have to have that tension between individuality and your responsibility to the community. I land on the conservative side, which is more individualistic because power tends to coagulate and because people who have power want to hold on to it and don't want to give it up and just want more and more power. And so the cry of the individual, the yearning of the individual always has a romantic power to it that really appeals to me. But I understand that obsessive individualism can lead to cruelty and selfishness and a society that can't maintain itself. So there's always room for There's no solution to this tension. There's no solution to the tension between individualism and community. There's no system that will solve it. There's no absolute way of doing it. You have to have those values of agape love that are so central to Christianity, where you say, yes, I am an individual, but part of my individualism is to love my neighbor as I love myself. I have to love myself, but I have to love my neighbor as I love myself. And that's where you have the balance worked out. The only thing I would add that keeps me on the conservative side is when you talk about charity, when you talk about the debt we owe to one another, the fact that we can't leave one another, we can't leave our neighbor lying in the gutter, we have to help him up in whatever way we can. The only thing I have to say about that is it's based on reality, not on theory. Charity is not about how virtuous you are. It's about what you do for the person you're helping. That's why Jesus wanted us to be charitable in secret. He didn't want us to be charitable in order to get credit for it. He wanted us to be charitable in order to actually help the person that we were striving to help. And that brings me to what's going on in Cuba. Now that I have a home to protect, I cannot wait to get my Ring security system in there. Wherever you are, Ring lets you know what is going on outdoors around your house. It is peace of mind anytime, knowing that your home is protected. Now that I have a house, I will be able to keep an eye on every corner of it with Ring's easy-to-install indoor and outdoor cams. It's never been more important to be able to see who's there or what's happening around the house, inside or outside. And you can see it all on one simple app on your phone, no matter where you are. With Ring, your family and you will be able to keep an eye on your home if you're traveling, no matter where you are, even if you're in bed and you just want to see what's going on outside. You will never miss a visitor, never miss anything going on. Start protecting your home today with Ring Alarm. Go to ring.com/Klavan to get your Ring Alarm security kit today. You can build the system that's right for your home and have it up and running in minutes. I can too, now that I have a home. So go to ring.com/Klavan. That's ring.com/Klavan. Anyone comes to your house, wherever you are, say to them, how do you spell Klavan? And if they know, call the police. the uprising we saw in Cuba, the mass demonstrations, the spontaneous demonstrations, and the fearless demonstrations in a, what is essentially a police state where you can vanish very easily, and people have vanished since those demonstrations took place. It was unprecedented. In 60 years of communism, 60 years of brutal communism, 60 years of mass murdering communism, this is the first time we've really seen this kind of rebellion. And, you know, people in Cuba live in intense fear. They infiltrate any demonstration and make sure their leaders disappear. So what happened? What happened? Well, first of all, they got internet. So for about 3 years, they had some social media, so they got to connect with one another. And then there was COVID-19, and things were going really badly. Why are they protesting? Why are they protesting communism? You know, the State Department tried to make it sound like, oh, they're just protesting the fact that their treatment for COVID-19 is not going well. But no, they were protesting the actual, what they call the revolution. And we've talked about this before, that the constitutional limits that we have on government create the illusion that there's such a thing as the state that loves you, right? Because we have had constitutional limits on government, the people who go into government are restrained in their love of power. And that makes us think, gee, government is a good thing, so we can trust government to redistribute wealth. We can trust government to take care of our health care. We can trust government to do all those things, giving government more and more power. And then you find out that the state, this beneficent state, this generous state, was always an illusion. In fact, all the state is people with power, and you give them more power, they become more corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely, and that's what happened in Cuba. You know, they often point out, the people who like the left and the people who want to maintain this theory of communism, which is supposed to work and supposed to make everything fair, they like to talk about the fact that Fidel Castro, at the end of the 50s, overthrew a brutal dictator, Batista. And that is true. I mean, Batista started out as an efficient, a dictator, but an efficient dictator. Then he basically went through a period where he left the country and went to Florida, came back to Cuba, and just was an absolute tyrant. And he had taken over from a tyrant before him. They like to say that the guy before him was a liberal, but he was a mass murdering tyrant too. So they've just had one mass murderer after another. And Fidel Castro was just another one. He killed at least 11,000 people, just murdering them, taking over. He has been a thug from the beginning, and he always was. And the thing is, the way that communism usually rises up is that there's corruption or oppression, and the communists who take office are frequently motivated by a theory, and that theory makes them idealistic. And then when they get into power and they realize that their theory doesn't work, but they have all this power, rather than abandon the theory, which has been the motivating factor of their life, and say, oh, the theory doesn't work, let's go back to reality, they just start to enjoy the power and start to lock down on the people. And nothing the left loves like a theory. They have this old joke where the left says, yes, that will work in fact, but will it work in theory? And that is the thing. Communism may work in theory. Socialism may work in theory. And that's why it's so popular in places where you don't have to prove yourself. The academy, Hollywood, the news media, where you don't have to build things that work. You can just talk about how generous you are. They love that theory. It makes them feel generous. But once you have the power, it just doesn't work because the state is based on a lie. It's based on the lie of a benevolent state. So when Castro died, I guess about 5 years ago, the press could not let go of the fact that this guy was a murdering tyrant. That if you go to Cuba, the place looks like it's still the 1950s. They're driving these old cars. If you drive a cab, the police pull you over and take bribes from you. It is an entire place that runs on corruption and on oppression. And this is the way, listen to the way the news media treated the death of Fidel Castro.
What he's done in Cuba has been a success in the sense that Cuba has one of the highest literacy rates in the world. They have doctors that they send, again, all over the world.
By then a declared socialist, he dramatically improved health care and literacy.
Many saw positives, education and health care for all, racial integration.
You see the medicine system they are very proud of. You see athletes, and think of how many Cuban athletes have enriched the sports in this country and around.
I'm quite certain that they're not celebrating his death in Cuba, and he brought health care, and he got rid of Batista, and he made literacy a part of the Cuban government.
Even Castro's critics praised his advances in health care and in education.
And he was the original revolutionary. He was the man the people called the great revolutionary.
Castro was considered, even to this day, the George Washington of his country.
Wow, I just hope that I can murder enough people to get that kind of reaction from the press when I die. I mean, I'm not sure I have a big enough kill count to make it into the hearts and minds of the press, but Fidel Castro certainly did. And you kept hearing that one refrain, the healthcare, so much, oh, the healthcare. Michael Moore made an entire film about this. Michael Moore, the make-believe communist who parks his limousine around the corner before walking into a building so no one will see how badly he treats the many, many servants he has from his millions and millions of dollars that he's made making communist movies. Michael Moore made an entire film, 2007, called Sicko, about how wonderful, wonderful the healthcare system was in Cuba. Here's just a little bit of that.
The Cuban people have free, universal healthcare. They become known around the world as having not only one of the best healthcare systems, but as being one of the most generous countries in providing doctors and medical equipment to third world countries. In the U.S., healthcare costs run nearly $7,000 per person. But in Cuba, they spend only $251. And yet, the Cubans are able to have a lower infant mortality rate than the United States, a longer average lifespan than the United States. They believe in preventive medicine. And it seems like there's a doctor on every block. Their only sin when it comes to healthcare seems to be that they don't do it for a profit.
Every word of that is false. So, I mean, think about this for a minute. If the healthcare is so great that every news media, every news outlet was praising Fidel Castro for his healthcare, Michael Moore makes an entire movie about it. They take to the streets and suddenly the State Department is saying, well, it's because of COVID. Where's their great health care? Where's the great health care that was going to save everybody and all? They just don't care about the profits. Here's what happened. I will tell you what happened. Cuba is broke. It's not because they keep saying, well, it's because of the embargo. It's the American embargo. America does not embargo food and medicine. It sends them medicine. It sends them food. And of course, it also sends them dollars because people who, you know, the number of Cuban Americans, of people who have left Cuba and are now Americans, it's about a fifth of the number of people who live in Cuba. So it's about 2 million, say, Cuban Americans, and there's about 11 million Cubans. The few Cubans who live in America make more in the aggregate, and they're not one of the highest earning minorities in America. They make more than the entire island of Cuba. Okay, so their economy in Cuba stinks. They are broke. What do they do about being broke? Well, they do train a lot of doctors, and basically they human traffic these doctors and send them to other places, take the money from them. They don't let the doctors make the money. They take it back and they feed it back into the regime. And when I say back into the regime, it's not into healthcare for the people. It's for the mansions and the women that all these tyrants always have. So they are using, they're essentially trafficking their doctors when they say they're sending them out in charity to these places. No, they are feeding the mouths of the dictators by sending these guys out and making doctors. People in America, when Cubans in America or Cuban Americans make money here and they send those dollars back to their family, you know what happens? The family gets the dollars, but then the government sets up stores that have much needed items in them that only accept dollars. And so you have to go in and buy those with your dollars that you got from America. And where do those dollars go? Back into the economy to feed people and help it? No, of course not. They go back into the regime. They rule by terror. They always rule by terror. And what happened was they got the internet 3 years ago and people started talking. These rappers and artists and poets started sending around, paeans to freedom, basically. And the rappers, one of the rappers had this thing, Fatherland, Fidel's motto was fatherland or death. But the rappers are saying, no more lies. My people demand freedom. No more doctrines. Let us no longer shout fatherland or death, but fatherland and life. Fatherland and life. You wonder why I talk about the culture all the time. You wonder why I talk about the arts and why they won't let constitutionalists get near Hollywood and why they won't let anybody who believes in freedom get near Hollywood or work in Hollywood. This is why. This is why. Because when you hear the artists, when the artists come, they touch your heart. They remind you of that yearning you have for freedom, that yearning you have to be an individual and have your individuality count for something and mean something in the world. And they do not want that yearning to breathe free. So the people take to the streets and they wave the American flag and they shout Libertad. And now they've all been shut down. They took away their internet. They basically are incommunicado. The entire island is incommunicado. But they're out there waving American flags and shouting Libertad. And Joe Biden, who is the make-believe president, he made all the right comments. This is cut nine.
Cuban people demanding their freedom from an authoritarian regime. And I don't think we've seen anything like this protest in a long, long time, if quite frankly ever. The United States stands firmly with the people of Cuba as they assert their universal rights. And we call on the government of Cuba, to refrain from violence or attempts to silence the voice of the people of Cuba.
So he's saying the right things right there, but what is he doing? I mean, he's trying to pass trillions of dollars in spending that will make the government enormous. It will make government spending enormous and socialistic. I mean, he's going to say, oh, we're going to pay for your child. You know, you're going to get all this money if you have a child, and we're going to take care. There's going to be daycare where we can teach them that he thinks he's a boy, but he's not really a boy. We can teach them critical race theory so he will hate his neighbor for being a different color or hate himself for being white. They are not going to let Cubans escape from Cuba. Our southern border is unprotected. People are pouring in from South America and Mexico. People are just pouring in, and they won't do anything about it. I mean, they sent Kamala Harris to look into it, look into the root causes. They want to find the root causes. How are they reacting to the uprising in Cuba? Don't come here. This is Alejandro Mayorkas, the head of Homeland Security. This is his message to the Cuban people.
Allow me to be clear. If you take to the sea, you will not come to the United States. The time is never right to attempt migration by sea. To those who risk their lives doing so, this risk is not worth taking. Again, I repeat, do not risk your life attempting to enter the United States illegally. You will not come to the United States.
What's the difference between a Mexican and a Cuban? They think the Mexicans will vote Democratic. That's the difference. They lost Florida because, for one reason, was because the Cuban Americans who live down there are not going to vote for Democrats because they know socialism when they see it. The reaction on the left is a reaction to preserve the idea of communism, the theory of communism. When I say that charity is based on reality, I mean it's based on results. Your intentions don't matter a damn. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. You ever think about that slogan, the road to hell is paved with good intentions? You know, shouldn't it be paved with like flaming skulls or something like that? No, it's paved with good intentions because good intentions make you feel good. They parade your virtue, but they don't do anything for the people that you are supposedly trying to help. Listen to the left cover up for the communist regime. Here's Reuters. They're very concerned. They say Cuban protests risk exacerbating COVID-19 spike. Did they worry about that when BLM was burning down Portland and Minneapolis? Did they worry about the COVID-19 spike? No, because actually, if you're a communist, you don't spread COVID-19. It's only when you protest communism that suddenly you spread COVID-19. It's like a mask. Communism is like a mask, you know, that protects you from spreading COVID-19. Black Lives Matter can burn cities to the ground, can completely destroy businesses, destroy dreams, destroy lives, but they won't spread COVID because they are a Marxist organization. How do we know? Because here's what Black Lives Matter said about Cuba. Black Lives Matter, this is their statement, Black Lives Matter condemns the U.S. federal government's inhumane treatment of Cubans and urges it to immediately lift the economic embargo. It's all our fault that communism never works. Remember, BLM was started by two, what they described themselves as, was trained Marxists, and they do not want to let the theory go because the theory makes you virtuous, but the reality makes people slaves. It happens again and again and again. AOC, Alexandria Occasional Cortex, she put out a thing saying, oh, we stand with the people of Cuba, but it's all America's fault as well. And just remember, you know, they're out there waving. It breaks your heart. They're out there waving the American flag and shouting Libertad. But what are we saying about the American flag? A headline in the New York Times for July 4th was a 4th of July symbol of unity. The flag may no longer unite. Jen Psaki was challenged on this about the flag. Here's Cut 11.
Recently, the New York Times described the American flag as alienating to some, but we've seen these Cuban protesters flying the American flag as a symbol for freedom. We saw it in Hong Kong as well. So does the administration support international protesters flying the American flag? And what message do you have to Americans who are wary of flying it here in the U.S.?
Well, I would say first, the president certainly values and respects the symbol of the American flag. He's someone who certainly waves it outside of his house or does in Delaware and other places where he's lived throughout his time. But he also believes that people have the right to peaceful protests, and he thinks both can be true.
here's what Joe Biden with his American flag. What's left of Joe Biden, anyway, here's what Joe Biden is saying about America. In America, in many states, they're trying to secure elections by having people show ID, by having people not collect other people's votes. Just basic stuff. This is what he says about it. Cut 13.
This year alone, 17 states have enacted, not just proposed, but enacted 28 new laws to make it harder for Americans to vote. Not to mention, and catch this, nearly 400 additional bills Republican members of the state legislatures are trying to pass. The 21st century Jim Crow assault is real. It's unrelenting.
Yeah, it's 21st century Jim Crow. Why would he fly the American flag? I wouldn't if I thought this country was riddled with Jim Crow, if I thought this was the greatest crisis in the world since the Civil War, which he also said. The U.S. State Department has invited UN experts who investigate racism and minority issues to conduct an official visit to the United States, Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said. Blinken says, this is also, he's speaking for Winken and Nod here. Winken, Blinken, and Nod say responsible nations must not shrink from scrutiny of their human rights accord. Rather, they should acknowledge it with the intent to improve. The Cubans are waving the American flag, but not the Americans, not these Americans, not these leftist Americans. They are the regime. They are the Cuban regime. I know they're not mass murdering. I'm not accusing them of that. And I know that they're not a brutal communist regime, but they are a communist regime. They are socialists. And it's the same thing. The illusion that the state is going to take care of you is an illusion that lasts just until the state has the power to stomp on you. And it will. It always does. It always has. Why should it be any different? You know, there's an old Irving Berlin song. It's in a Fred Astaire and Bing Crosby movie that ends, "I'll see you in CUBA." And that's the way I feel about the Democrats. We see you in CUBA. We know why you're standing up for that regime. We know who you are. We see you in CUBA. If you are looking for parts for your car, and if you're also looking for love at the same time, I can answer both questions for you. You just got to say rockauto.com. Women love the sound of that because it means you are smart enough not to let your car just sit there in the driveway when it needs a part, not to walk down to the car parts store and talk to some clown who doesn't know any more than you do. When you say rockauto.com, it means you are smart enough to go online, your own computer, and look at Rock Auto's unique catalog, which is remarkably easy to navigate. It has a great selection of car and car body parts that you can order online and get great prices. Go to rockauto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car or truck. And when they ask you, how did you hear about us? Say Klavan in that same tone of voice. Oh man, that'll drive the girls insane. That way they'll know we sent you. They'll know we sent you just by the way you talk, just by the fact that when you go online, you say rockauto.com. So the left has fallen into this kind of hilarious little cycle because we see them, because we see who they are, and because Joe Biden is just a kind of moderate face they have put on this leftist program that they have, and because we see that too, the leftists speak up, they get caught, then they say that they didn't say what they said, and then they silence anyone who opposes them. This is a cycle they go through again and again. They say, we're going to defund the police, and say, you can't do that. We didn't say we were going to defund the police. The Republicans said that. But yes, you did. Shut up. It goes again and again and again. Listen, here's James Clyburn, right? All they want to do is make sure that people can identify themselves. All the Republicans want to do is make sure that people identify themselves when they go to vote, that they can't, that they want to protect against fraud. So James Clyburn, so people said, you know, most people of all races, most people think, yes, of course you should identify yourself. So James Clyburn, who's the majority whip, who still has a bit of a sense of reality left. He's the guy who engineered Biden's victory because he realized nobody was going to vote for Elizabeth Warren. Nobody was going to vote for the radicals like Kamala Harris. So he's the guy who engineered marshaling the black vote to boost up Biden so at least people would have a moderate face to vote for. And he says, no, 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 we don't want, we have nothing against voter IDs. Cut four.
There's not a single time that I've ever voted in my entire life. Now I'm going to be 81 years old next week. There's not a single time that I voted when I did not ID myself. What I spoke about was allowing an ID, a picture ID of a hunter's license to be good, but of a student activity card to be no good. That's the kind of voter ID law that I'm talking about that's unfair. I've said that all of my life. I don't know why you guys keep misrepresenting what I said. I have never said that you should not have voter ID. When I got my voter registration card, I keep it in my wallet, and when I go to vote, I presented that every time. And I say to them, I am Jim Clyburn, this is my ID, and I want to vote. I've always had voter ID. And that's why the representative earlier told you, no Democrat has ever been against voter ID.
No Democrat has ever been against voter ID. First they say it, no voter ID. Then they tell you they didn't say it. Here's Kamala Harris when she was asked about voter ID. What's wrong with voter ID? Cut seven.
In some people's mind, that means, well, you're going to have to Xerox or photocopy your ID to send it in to prove you are who you are. Well, there are a whole lot of people, especially people who live in rural communities, who don't. There's no Kinko's. There's no Office Max near them. People have to understand that when we're talking about voter ID laws, be clear about who you have in mind and what would be required of them to prove who they are.
That sounds like she's against voter ID. Shut up. Shut up. No. It's the cycle. The same thing. They say it. We protest. They say they didn't say it. And then they shut you up. They take you off Facebook. They take you off Twitter. They do whatever they have to do to silence the truth. I mean, it's the same thing with crime. They defund the police in Oakland. They said they were going to defund the police. And then they cut the budget a little bit. They redirected funds. Of course, there's a criminal explosion. I mean, the whole thing, this is happening in L.A., too, when you have DAs, you have these George Soros-backed liberal DAs who will not prosecute laws, who won't institute bail, who just arrest people, say, don't murder anybody anymore and be gone with you, my fine friend. You know, you have all these murders. So in Oakland, the black people who are frequently the victims of these high crimes go out to protest. They go out to protest the fact that their people are being killed. 70% of black people think that crime is a crisis in the country. White Antifa thugs show up and shout them down. Here's a little bit of that video, 27.
You don't have a right to be here.
Black children are dying in the street every day.
Yeah, at the hands of the police.
Yeah. No!
That's
a lie.
There are not hundreds of people dead at the hands of police this year.
You can make a list of thousands of people if you go back in history. We're talking about right now. What do you have against safety in Oakland? What do you have against stopping the violence? Why are you trying to disrupt something that's trying to be positive? Why do you have to be you disrupting something that's positive? We're trying to save our people. We're trying to save our people. You are not our people. Get the f*** out.
I mean, I shouldn't. I'm sorry. I'm laughing. I'm laughing because it's so absurd. It's so incredibly absurd. First, they say defund the police. Then they say Republicans said to defund the police, not us. Then when the consequences show up and people say, hey, you know, our people are dying here. Our people are dying. Antifa shows up to shut them down and silence them and shout them down. What? what does it mean? I mean, how can anybody even put in their heads the fact that white men in masks show up into a black neighborhood to silence them when they are mourning their dead and protesting the rise in crime? And that's Antifa. It's kind of just like, you know, what did they say it over at NPR? They said, oh, it's just like when the guys, the Antifa people, invaded Normandy to fight the fascists there. It's kind of like that, except completely the opposite. Unbelievable. And they always say it's just the messaging. I love it. It's just the messaging. It's not the actual fact of what they're doing. It's not the actual socialism. It's not the actual antipathy toward the police. It's not the actual racism that's involved in CRT. Here's the old Clinton hand, James Carville, saying, oh, these people, it's the language. They're all into the language. Cut three.
The overwhelming number of Democrats, most important constituents in our party, are blacks and suburban women. They're not into this. All right. And you know, again, we're seeing it time and time again. We're letting a noisy wing of our party define the rest of us. And my point is, we can't do that. I think these people are all kind of nice people. I think they're very naive and they're all into language and identity. And that's all right. They're not storming the Capitol, but they're not winning elections.
It's all about winning elections. You know, it's the same with critical race theory. They come out with this incredibly hateful, incredibly racist idea, this critical race theory. And they're teaching it in schools, and they're teaching it in K through 12, and they're insisting on teaching it. And the parents start to show up and protest. And the news media says, no, that didn't happen at all. This is from Media Research Center. They put together this montage, 23.
State after state, Fox News and Republicans, conservatives have whipped up a moral panic about so-called critical race theory.
This is just the latest outrage device over at Fox, is it not?
A bad faith effort by Republicans to make critical race theory a wedge issue.
By the way, critical race theory is enormously useful. It's a graduate level construct. It's not taught in K through 12.
Again, it is not being taught in grade schools.
No one is teaching critical race theory K through 12.
Just to be clear, can you just repeat it? It is a law school test. What is critical race theory?
What is critical race theory? I suspect it's not as major an issue as we've made it out to be in the media.
And here's a montage, again, from Media Research Center of teachers, grade school teachers, talking about critical race theory. Cut 24.
Racism is systematic. So it's impossible to be systematically racist to white people in an American society.
Teaching that systemic racism exists isn't in itself a racist practice. That is the first step toward healing, which this country desperately needs.
I am part of the equity and racial justice team at my school district and have been mentoring students of color who have been leading these changes in our district. They have implemented new curriculum that is unwhitewashed.
These children's quote-unquote history books are so problematic. When kids learned about the American Revolution, we learned about one black man on the front of the book and everybody else in here is white.
Even though I'm a kindergarten teacher, I am very active in education reform.
In honor of the anniversary of George Floyd's death, let's have a hot take on education. Let's talk about how schools marginalize African-American students.
There is going to be a right side of history and a wrong side of history. When you stay out of it, you're on the wrong side.
Say it, deny you say it, and shut up anybody who says you're still saying it. You know, left and I don't divide politics anymore between left and right. I divide it between friends of the founding and enemies of the founding. If you're a friend of the founding, if you believe in limited government, if you believe in the sacred right of the individual to speak freely, to defend himself, to be a full, complete free individual. I think there's lots of compromises that could be made on people on the left and right of those that system. The people who say, I want to be a total individual, I want to be completely individualistic, and the people who say, no, you have a debt to the community, there is a conversation to be had there. You know, sometimes people on the right say, well, there should only be private charity. That works if you live in a small community where everybody goes to the same church or everybody has the same general beliefs. Maybe everybody trusts each other, likes each other. But in an America, a multi-ethnic America, where there are so many different kinds of people, so many people who distrust each other, who don't even know one another, who don't even understand how each other lives, I could see where there has to be some kind of government system for keeping people, from falling into the gutter, from disappearing off the grid. I understand that. That is a conversation you can have. But it's all about reality. It is all about what really helps. What really helps is giving people hand up to get them back into the workforce, not the kind of great society system that basically inculcates dependency and breaks apart families and is the reason we have so much dysfunction, not just in black communities, but in all poor communities that live off the dole. Listen, there's a tension in America and in Western civilization between the individual and society. That tension is what makes us who we are. But these are not people on the left who are actually trying to resolve that tension in a creative way. These are people who just desperately want all the power in their corner so they can crush the individual spirit that has made this country what it is and has made this country so incredibly great. I spend a lot of time in a chair. I work in a chair at a desk. And if you want a great chair, you want the X chair. The X chair can give you a massage while you're sitting at your desk. It can warm your back on cold mornings. It can cool you off on hot days. Elimax temperature regulation will take your seating comfort to a whole new level. Patent pending Elimax allows you to experience cooling, heat, and massage in your lower back. X-Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar DVL support was already best in class with incredible responsive low back support. X-Chair is on sale now for $100 off. Go to xchairclavin.com right now. That's the letter X, chairclavin.com, or call 1-844-4X-Chair. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. Go to xchairclavin.com now and use code XWheels for free X-Wheel blade casters. xchairclavin.com. And you're saying you can probably spell X. You might be able to spell chair, but Clavin, it is K-L-A-V-A-N. K-L-A-V-A-N, there are no easy things. I just make it look easy. So let's talk about Superman's sex life, because I actually think it's an important topic and it tells us a lot about superhero movies. You know, T.S. Eliot, the great American poet, had a wonderful line where he said, "The great poet in writing himself writes his time." And I think that that is true, that great works like Hamlet not only show you something about the moment that Shakespeare is living in, and they show you so much about the moment that in some ways they predict the future. And I've talked about that in the past. But I think that art overall, the culture overall, is always speaking to us about its moment and the moment that we're living in. And in speaking about the moment, it's also speaking about the future, because if you really understand the moment, you can kind of see where things are going. And I think that's true of great work, but I also think it's true of general work. In other words, if you take the culture as a whole and you're not looking for any works of genius, you take the culture as a whole, you start to see what people are thinking about. The rise of superhero movies is part of the rise of fantasy and science fiction. Obviously, it is a kind of fantasy and a kind of science fiction too. And that came along with the rise in technology. When I was a kid, science fiction was a secondary genre. The big genres were crime stories, detective stories, westerns, war movies. All of them were in some sense about the past. I mean, the detective story is about reassembling the past. Obviously, Western movies and war movies are about things that happened in the past. And even monster movies back in the day, and I was as a little kid, I was a big monster movie fan. The monsters were very human, and they were also in some ways about the past. Monsters like The Mummy came from the past. Dracula came from the past. Superheroes, I think, represent an inner sense that as technology advanced, I mean, there were superheroes then, but it only became a major, major genre. As technology advanced, we started to have this sense that the human beings were going to become more than human beings. They were going to be welded to technology. They were going to have things inserted in their brain to make them smarter, stronger, faster. They would live longer. They would have limb replacements. They might even become something like immortal. And I think superheroes are so popular because they are a human idea of what the human future might look like. And I hate these movies. I've always talked about how much I dislike them. What is wrong with them? Why do I hate these movies? And the reason I hate them is I watch them, and no matter how they try to be serious, no matter how they try to address serious issues, serious ethical issues, they don't address the central human issues of sex and death, what used to be called eros and thanatos. It's not just having sex and dying. It is about the idea of eros, of the erotic, and mortality in human life. And those two things go together. Sex and death go together, because if you're an amoeba, you just split and you are immortal. Two amoebas are the same as one amoeba. It doesn't matter. But as people become, as organisms become more complex, they have to use sex to reproduce. And as they do that, then they, the personal I, dies, and your child becomes your bid into the future of the world. So if you get rid of death, sex becomes unnecessary and meaningless. And this, and yet the problems of death, of course, are what science has been trying to solve all along. And in doing so, in some ways, they also solve sex. They get rid of sex. Superman, if you look at him, is super, but he's also kind of impotent. He's also a sexless creature. There was a famous essay by Larry Niven, who a very famous science fiction writer, back in the 70s, who wrote an essay called Man of Steel, Woman of Kleenex. And it began, he's faster than a speeding bullet. He's more powerful than a locomotive. He's able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Why can't he get a girl? He says at the ripe old age of 31, Kal-El, alias Superman, alias Clark Kent, is still unmarried. Almost certainly he's still a virgin. He talks about why this is. He says, what arouses Kal-El's mating urge? Did Kryptonian women carry some subtle mating cue at appropriate times of the year? Whatever it was, Lois Lane doesn't have it. We may speculate that she smells wrong, less like a Kryptonian woman, more like a terrestrial monkey. He says there are other problems. Electroencephalograms taken of men and women during sexual intercourse show that orgasm resembles a kind of pleasurable epileptic attack. One loses control over one's muscles. Superman has been known to leave his fingerprints in steel and in hardened concrete. What would he do to the woman in his arms during what amounts to an epileptic fit? And he goes on, he says, consider the driving urge between a man and woman, the monomaniacal urge to achieve greater and greater penetration. Remember also that we are dealing with Kryptonian muscles. Superman would literally crush Lois Lane's body in his arms while simultaneously ripping her open from crotch to serve. He goes on and on with this. He says he'd blast the top of her head off. There was a hint of this, you know, back in the end of 1970s, 1980s Superman movies with Christopher Reeve. There was Superman 3 was a real bomb and people hated it. And one of the reasons they hated it was there was a scene where Superman wants to have sex with and essentially marry Lois Lane. And he has to consult in a very Freudian sequence. He consults this AI creation of his mother. And he says, what do I have to do in order to be able to have a sexual relationship with Lois Lane? And here's what Mom tells him from Superman 3.
Your father and I tried to anticipate your every question, Kal-El. This is the one we hoped you would not ask.
But I have to, because she's everything I want in life.
And she, the one you have chosen, she feels as much for you?
Yes.
Then if this is what you wish, if you intend to live your life with a mortal, you must live as a mortal. You must become one of them. This crystal chamber has harnessed the rays of the red sun of Krypton. Once exposed to these rays, all your great powers on Earth will disappear forever. But consider, once it is done, there is no return. You will become an ordinary man. You will feel like an ordinary man. You can be hurt like an ordinary man.
You know, because sex and death go together, if you're immortal, sex becomes meaningless and essentially useless. So if you want to have a truly sexual relationship, you have to accept death. And that's what she's saying to him. You have to become immortal. Immortal. And there's always been something sexless about superheroes. They wear these tight costumes that emphasize their manly physique and their womanly physique. But how do you get out of those costumes? How do you undress? I always look at them and think, boy, you know, it'd be really difficult to actually seduce this person when she's wearing this one-piece leather suit, probably made out of some indestructible material. There's always been, because of this, there's always been something infantile about the superhero imagination. It is really interesting to me. Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel were the co-creators of Superman. And Shuster was one of the artists. He had this secret obsession. They wrote a book about it called Secret Identity, but he was into S&M and he was into women, dominant women. Here's a picture, if you're watching, here's a picture, one of the pictures he drew, dominant women basically whipping and bond, and, you know, using bondage on and tormenting men. And the thing about, I've talked about fetishism before, the thing about fetishism is not a question of being good or evil, but it freezes you in childhood trauma. Fetish comes from childhood trauma, and it freezes you in that moment of trauma and doesn't let you develop into a full, mature sexual relationship. And what's interesting, fascinating to me, is not only the most famous male superhero was created in part by an S&M guy, but so was the most famous female superhero heroine, Wonder Woman, with her rope that she ties people up with. She was invented by a guy named William Marston, who was a professor who had a relationship with two women at once, and they were very into the same thing. Bondage, whipping, spanking, female dominance. There was a movie made about him called Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. And here's the scene where Marston explains to these two women his idea for Wonder Woman. And it's a comical scene because he's basically explaining his fetishistic imagination. Here it is.
A comic book, Bill?
Well, it's perfect. I'm going to inject my ideas right into the thumping heart of America. I mean, I'll get a real artist to draw it properly.
She's an Amazon princess that lives on an island of all women.
Paradise Island.
And a man crash lands on the island.
Steve Trevor the spy.
And she wears a burlesque outfit.
Well, it's athletic.
And silver bracelets.
They deflect bullets.
And all her friends and helpers are sorority girls who have spanking parties and everybody fights Nazis and rides in an invisible plane.
Yes. What?
Bill, we love you, truly. But nobody, and I say this with all the compassion and truth in my heart, nobody will ever publish this.
Wonder Woman is essentially the fantasy of a guy who fantasized about dominant women tying people up and beating them, tying men up and beating them. And what's fascinating is when they made the Gal Gadot film, the Wonder Woman film, which was a really entertaining movie, a lot of women, a lot of female movie critics said they cried when Wonder Woman did her heroic dominant actions, when she fought and won that battle in World War I. Meredith Warner in the LA Times said she cried when she saw this. This is what she needed. So in other words, this was an example of women's empowerment. And what's fascinating to me about this is essentially the idea, the feminist idea of women's empowerment is a sexual fantasy of a man, man's fantasy of the all-powerful woman. And it makes perfect sense that the same imagination that imagines an all-powerful woman imagines himself to be an all-powerful man. In other words, Superman and Wonder Woman are part of that same fetishistic imagination. They really are. And again, it's not a question of good or bad. It's just a question of being infantile. Here's the thing. The science fiction is said to begin with Mary Shelley. And Mary Shelley, of course, was the teenage girl who invented Frankenstein. And Frankenstein is frequently said to be a man who tries to be God by inventing life. And in fact, that's kind of in the movie. If you see the famous scene where Frankenstein first comes to life, can you play that? See, he says, I know what it's like to be God. Mary Shelley herself said it was a man who essentially was playing God, but he's not playing God. He's making life out of things that are already there, which is what men do already. What he's playing is he's playing a woman. He's bringing life into the world without a woman. And I really do believe that that is part of the fantasy, the feminist fantasy of equality. Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was actually dissenting against a decision that she thought limited abortion rights, said that in order for women to be equal, to realize their full potential, that is intimately connected with their ability to control their reproductive lives. In other words, they have to be able to kill their babies in order to be equal with men. They have to stop being women in order to be equal with men. They are accepting an idea of strength, an idea of equality that comes from that infantile mind, that the idea of female empowerment is that idea, is essentially the idea of becoming a male, and that a woman's equality is dependent on her not being a woman. The thing is, this is what I was talking about before, about being interdependent, about being defined by our relationship with other people, about being wives and husbands, brothers and children and neighbors, that part of the relationship between men and women is part of what a man is and part of what a woman is defined by their relationship to one another. And what is at the center of that relationship is the fact that women have children. And having children, they become infinitely valuable, but infinitely vulnerable. When a woman is pregnant, obviously, has got to be protected. And the fact that her offspring are the offspring of the world, is the future of the human race, makes her infinitely valuable. In protecting a woman, a man puts himself at risk. And what superheroes do is they eliminate all that. They eliminate, since they're virtually immortal, they eliminate the need for sexuality and reproduction at all, since they are invulnerable. They are not taking, a man is not taking any risk in defending a woman. And since the woman is just as strong as he is, she doesn't need to be protected. They are essentially getting rid of the gendered embodiment of humankind. It is an imagination of the future without human beings. We are sacrificing our humanity to get rid of gender, to get rid of inequality, to get rid of death. And the thing is, I'm not sure that's going to look as good as people think it does. You know, right now, we saw how people reacted to the flu, to the Chinese flu. If you can live forever, you won't live forever. You'll still be subject to accident. You can't live more than 800 years without the chance of having a fatal accident. How frightened will we be then? When you go outdoors, you're risking 800 years of life. It may not look as beautiful as we think it will. It is interesting to me that the other version of human perfection and the human future, which is the Gospels, begins with God choosing a mother for himself. God doesn't have to do that. If God had wanted to become incarnate, he could have snapped his godlike fingers and simply become a man, but he doesn't. He, in fact, chooses a mother for himself because he knows that mothers are the central fact of humanity, the central origin of humanity. The origin story of humanity is motherhood. The dependency that we experience in humanity teaches us gratitude and teaches us generosity. It teaches us our humanity. It is an interesting thing to me that what human beings imagine for their future, for their best future, is an inhuman future. But what God imagines for us is a gendered, embodied future where we become more and more human, not less and less. All right, we got a terrific guest coming up, but first, let's talk about Candace Owens, because if there is one woman who is not afraid to speak her mind, it is Candace. And now she has an entire show where she does just that right here at The Daily Wire. It's called, get this, Candace. And every episode features her fearless brand of political commentary and in-depth interviews with interesting guests. Her latest episode, Cuba Communism and the Democratic Death Cult, is available right now on demand for Daily Wire members. If you haven't subscribed yet, get 25% off a new membership with code Candace at dailywire.com/subscribe. And while we're talking about The Daily Wire, let us talk about Benjamin Shapiro. You know, Nick Fuentes was just put on the no-fly list by the government for reasons they refuse to explain. In plain sight, our left-dominated institutions are weaponizing their authority, sharpening their blades, and cutting into the rights of dissidents to operate in society. That's why there's no better time to learn about what authoritarianism looks like, why it happens, and how to stop it. It may sound like a tall order, but Ben Shapiro explains it all in his new book, The Authoritarian Moment. In it, he helps people understand as much as they can about how we reach this point and how we can all begin to fight back. The Authoritarian Moment is the book you need at this moment, and Ben will be doing a live signing of the book on July 27th. So if you want to pre-order your signed copy and ask him some questions, head to premiercollectibles.com/moment. If you pre-order a copy, don't forget to type whatever your burning question may be into the prompter when you check out. And seriously, unless you want to live under an authoritarian regime intent on decreasing your freedom and increasing their power, it's time to start reading up and learning how to fight back. So as you know, we always like to bring on a guest to try and elevate the program, bring a little bit of intelligence and, insight into the show. And today we really hit the jackpot. We have Larry Elder. I hardly need to introduce him, but you know he's a nationally syndicated radio host. He has the Larry Elder Show. He's a best-selling author and a terrific guy. And he has just recently announced his candidacy for governor of California. Larry, it is good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Drew. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So you are a massively successful guy. You could be bathing like Scrooge McDuck in your gold coins and just like living the life. Why do you need this aggravation of running for the governorship of California?
You know, Andrew, I think this is an intervention. This is damage control. Honestly, this is the mission of mercy. This state is almost ungovernable. That's why for the first time in our nation's history, we've had a net migration of native Californians out of the state. There's a magazine called CEO Magazine. It's been around 17 years. And based upon things like taxes and spending, unfunded pension liability, and the degree to which the state is business friendly, California has been rated the worst state in which to do business for all 17 years of this magazine's existence. Wow. And one of the big issues, of course, is rising crime. We have rising homelessness. We have declining school standards. And we have an arrogant governor who imposed the most dramatic, the most severe lockdowns of any of the 50 states while he was munching away at that famous French Laundry restaurant with the very lobbyists and medical professionals that drafted the mandates that they were violating. And it isn't just that. He had his own kids enjoying in-person private education. He exempted his own winery from the mandates. And we have no idea how many businesses went bankrupt. We do know that only about half of all the jobs in California have been recovered, as opposed to two-thirds of the average state. And this guy is clueless. He's got to go. And a lot of people approach me, including Dennis Prager and people like Pastor Jack Hibbs and people like my friend and mentor, Lionel Chetwin, a longtime filmmaker. And they all said, come on, Larry, if not you, who, if not now, when? I've got real good name recognition in the state. I've been on every major market in the state from Sacramento down to San Diego. And I've been talking about these issues in my books, in my columns for some 30 years. I'm a native Californian. My dad came here, Drew, in 1945, right after the war. He's from the Jim Crow South, like most black people. And he came here on a run when he was a Pullman porter on the trains before the war. And he was shocked that he was able to walk into a restaurant in the front door and get a meal. And so my dad kind of made a mental note that maybe someday after the war, I will come to California. Pearl Harbor, my dad joins the Marines. I asked my dad one time why. He said two reasons. They go where the action is, and I love the uniforms. So he's stationed in Guam, where he was in charge of cooking for the quote-unquote colored soldiers. Staff sergeant gets out of the Army, gets out of the Marines, and goes back to Chattanooga, where he met and married my mom. I walked around two or three days to get him a job as a short order cook, and he was told, we don't hire So he said, this is BS. I'm going to L.A., get me a job as a cook. Walks around, and they told him, you don't have any references. My dad said, I need references to make ham and eggs. So they treated him the same way out in California. They're a little more genteel about it. He goes to an unemployment office, takes the first job he can get, 10 years cleaning toilets with a company called Nabisco Brand Bread, 10 years with another company called Barbara Ann Bread, both times cleaning toilets, cooked for a family on the weekend, went to night school to get his GED to get additional education. And my father was able to save up enough money, so he had a stay-at-home wife, my mother. The youngest of us had a stay-at-home wife, mother, until Dennis was in middle school. And my dad, believe it or not, saved his nickels and dime, Andrew, to buy a home that right now is valued at $600,000. I just checked Zillow. Wonderful for us, but it's still in the family. But anybody who tried to duplicate my dad's path, an eighth-grade dropout, if he worked three jobs, could not do it because the cost of living is so hellacious because we've had an anti-growth ethos in this state for the last 30 or 40 years. And so the average price of a home in California costs 150% more than the average price of a home outside of California. Yeah. And Leo Hanian, the real estate expert, economist from UCLA, tells me because of rules like, it's called CEQA, the California Quality Environmental Act, the average house in California costs 50% more than it otherwise would, but for these ridiculous environmental mandates. You stick a spoon in the dirt and somebody's going to file a lawsuit arguing that you've had a negative environmental impact. In preparing for this race, I talked to developers. I talked to contractors. I heard story after story after story. 20 years ago, Larry, I had a 2,000 home development on the projects. I got sued. I cut it down to 1,000. I got sued. I cut it down to 500. 25 years later, they approved a 200 development plot as opposed to a 2,000 development plot. That's why young people like Ben Shapiro and others are leaving California, going to places like Tennessee and Texas and Florida. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I'm going to reverse that when I become governor.
Let me ask you something. The minute I heard you were doing this, the first thing that went through my head was he could win this thing. I mean, you really, I listen to your show. Everybody listens to your show on the right. And you really know your stuff. You really know what you're doing. You're obviously personable.
Right.
Are you prepared for this? I mean, I don't want you to be like the dog that caught the car here, you know? I mean, people don't understand what L.A. looks like. I mean, it looks like Calcutta now. It looks like, you know, some of the worst places. The homelessness is terrible. San Francisco used to be one of the most beautiful cities in the country. It's virtually unlivable. What are you going to do about the homeless?
You know, I can't do any worse job than these clowns right now. Take Newsom. Newsom was the mayor of San Francisco. He was lieutenant governor for 8 years. He's been governor for 2 years. He's a disaster. And I know a pretty well-known governor who was pretty good and pretty well-known president. His name was Ronald Reagan. He came out of Hollywood, for crying out loud, and he won, and he governed extremely effectively. It takes common sense and good judgment. It's not rocket science. The rise in homelessness is in part due to the fact that we're purchasing homes for them, including very expensive homes in Venice Beach. And a lot of people outside of California coming here. You mean if I'm homeless, I'll be treated with compassion and I get a free home? And they're not doing anything about the underlying problem of why they're homeless in the first place. Pastor Jack Hibbs says, let us do it. Let the churches do it. We'll adopt a block. We'll adopt the street. Empower us. Give us the money, meaning not government, but have individuals donate money to the churches and let them do it. Some 10% or so, I'm told, Andrew, are people with true schizophrenics. A danger to themselves or to others. I'm sorry, they literally have to be forcibly picked up off the street and housed for their own protection and for the protection of the other homeless class. But the rest of them need to be treated. And we did have a stick that was removed by Proposition 47. A lot of people are stealing money to purchase drugs for their habit. And what Proposition 47 did is we're going to make these people no longer felons. They'll be committing misdemeanors. We'll give them tickets. And that's what they're doing. And so now you find people going in literally with calculators, making sure they don't steal more than 950. And they can do that every single day. Now, what's the incentive for somebody like that to get treatment if you don't have the threat that that person is going to go to jail? I've talked to Sheriff Alex Villanueva. He says we no longer have the tools to force these people to go into rehab because we can't threaten them with going to jail. This is ridiculous. We need to do something about this. And one of the reasons crime is going up, of course, is that we've demonized the police with this systemic racism BS narrative. When in fact, the studies show that the police are 3 times more hesitant and more reluctant to pull the trigger on a black suspect than a white suspect. Now, you're a cop. Much of police working, in fact, most of it is discretionary. You're driving around, you see something that looks bad, you get out of your car and you investigate. Why do that when the odds are someone's going to pick up a smartphone, film you, and accuse you of engaging in systemic racism? So a lot of cops are engaging what's called passive policing, not doing proactive policing. Bad guys know it. Crime goes up. And guess who are the primary people who are victimized? The very black and brown people that people like Gavin Newsom and people on the left claim they care about. Can I say something about school choice? I went to Crenshaw High School. You know the movie Boys in the Hood?
Yeah.
I read in the LA Times a few years ago, front page article, only 3% of kids from my former high school were math proficient. I recently checked the latest stats. 2% now are math proficient. Who sends their kid to a school where only 2% of the kids are math proficient and the school's a Crip school, meaning run by the gangs? The reason I know that is because shortly after I graduated from Crenshaw, the area became a gang area, and Ice-T, I get my ISIS confused, Ice-T, the rapper, said he chose Crenshaw because he wanted to go to a Crip school. By the way, speaking of Ice Cube raised by nuclear middle-class family, he did not go to his local government school. He voluntarily got on a bus and went to Taft High School in the Valley, which at the time was primarily white, because he wanted a better education. Now, what does that tell you? Twice as many LAUSD teachers who have school-age kids have their own kids in private school compared to those households that don't have teachers. Now, this is the equivalent of opening up a restaurant, putting up a sign saying, come on in, just don't eat the food. The people that know the school system the best are the ones who don't put their own kids in it. One more stat. There are 300,000 public school teachers in California. Guess how many were fired last year for incompetence, Drew?
I have no idea. How many?
Two. And I'm told by talking to experts, between 5 and 7% of them are incompetent, and they end up in the schools where the kids most need good schools. If they just didn't exist, the learning curve would go up. That's around 15,000 teachers that need to be fired. And when I become governor, I'm going to use my emergency powers the way Gavin Newsom has for the coronavirus mandate, and I'm going to get rid of these bad teachers in one fell swoop. Remember that crazy elementary school teacher who was literally feeding kids cookies laced with semen? You know how many years it took for them to get rid of this guy? And finally, he took a $40,000 buyout to get for him to leave. It takes almost $1 million to get rid of an incompetent teacher. It is outrageous. 80% of the kids who are in public schools in the state of California are black and brown. 75% of black kids cannot read at state levels of proficiency. 50% of all kids cannot. It is absolutely outrageous. And what is Gavin Newsom doing about it? Not a damn thing, because he's beholden to the teachers union. Remember, they didn't want the schools open. The teachers were still getting their money. And when parents, black and brown and others, began complaining, the head of the largest affiliate of the California Teachers Association in Los Angeles said, well, the move to have in-school learning during the coronavirus pandemic is being led by white supremacists. Andrew, I'm a lot of things. Do I look like a freaking white supremacist to you?
Can you answer this question to me?
Don't answer that. No, Larry, no. Every now and then, I'm saying.
Can you answer a question that really mystifies me? I lived in San Francisco way long, long time ago. It was a beautiful, beautiful city. L.A., the weather there, I mean, it's virtually paradise. Why do people put up with this? Why do they vote for a guy like George Gascon, the new DA, the Soros-backed DA, who will not prosecute crime? Why do they allow their streets to become crime-ridden, dangerous, tent cities? What does it take? What will it take to convince them that Larry Elder is easily and far and away a better choice than a guy like Gavin Newsom?
I have a theory about that.
Yeah.
I have friends who live in Oregon. I have friends who live in Florida, friends who live in Texas. And as you know, many of these states are threatening to become increasingly more purple as people from California come there.
Right.
Because the average Joe and Joe sick pack have no idea of the connection between the rising crime and stupid policies, the connection between the rising cost of living and stupid policies, the connection between homelessness and stupid policies. They just know it's bad. They just know they can't get a house, and they know I can go somewhere else and get one. They haven't put the two together, not because they're stupid. They're working. They're not like you and me. They're not policy guys. They're trying to put food on the table and trying to raise money to get the DP to get a house. They haven't made the connection. And one of the things I think I can do in a way that maybe none of the others can is explain this to the average Californian. There is a reason for this. Drought is God-made, but shortages are human-made. There's a reason for this. We have not prepared. We have not invested in our water infrastructure in any meaningful way since the 1970s. Bill Jones, the former Secretary of State, in my opinion, Drew, the last true conservative who was elected statewide, third generation farmer. And he said, my parents, my family are some of the ones who did the infrastructure. Some of the facilities are named after us, are named Jones. And he said, this infrastructure has not been added to in any kind of significant way since the 1970s, when the state was half the size. Now, how much common sense does it take to recognize that? I think I at least have that. So I'm looking forward to the challenge. I think I can do this. And when I've talked to a lot of people, including the black media in Sacramento, I said, aren't you tired of this? Aren't you tired of the crime? Aren't you tired of the fact that blacks and browns are more likely to be victimized than anybody else? Aren't you tired of sending your kid to a school where only 2% are math proficient? Aren't you sick of it? Don't you recognize it doesn't have to be this way? Why can't the money follow the child rather than the other way around? The guy that you guys have voted for are totally beholden to the teacher union. They hate charter schools, let alone private schools. Why? They lose the automatic membership dues that they normally get. A teacher who goes to a charter school is not automatically enrolled into the union. Therefore, the union does not get automatic dues. And that's why they discourage charter schools, they discourage homeschooling, they discourage private schools, while putting their own school-age kids in the very private schools that they discourage other parents from sending their kids to. It is outrageous, and that's one of the things I'm going to do something about, Drew.
You know, for people who don't live in California, there's a recall on Gavin Newsom that was difficult to put into action, but they are actually going to have it. What do you have to accomplish now to win? Do you have to be the leader of all the candidates? Do you have to win a plurality? What do you have to do to win?
Well, first thing I have to do is get money from people so I can run. electelder.com is my website, but you're right. This is real simple. There are two things on the ballot. Do you want this man recalled? Who should replace him? That's it. If there's 50% plus one vote, he's recalled. And then whoever has the highest number of votes to replace him wins. I have the highest name recognition of any of these people other than Caitlyn Jenner. And as I mentioned, I'm up and down the state. I'm extremely well known. I don't pretend to be a policy wonk. I don't pretend to know as much about how Sacramento works as some of these other people do. And when I get elected, they're going to get the first phone call because I'm going to need their expertise in my cabinet.
Okay. So another mystery to me is why Republicans look at states like California and look at states like New York, where things are going so badly and things are falling apart so much, and Republicans kind of stand down. They think, oh, no, we can't possibly win. As you say, there are supermajorities throughout California, the Democrats. It's basically a one-party state.
Yes.
Do you think the Republicans will make an effort? Do you think they will back you or at least somebody in trying to get rid of these guys?
I think I will. I think they will. I'm going to a big meeting tomorrow, and the scuttlebutt is that they're going to support somebody else. They haven't heard me, haven't seen me. Wait until I lay out what I just now laid out to you in the way that I'm doing it, with the passion, enthusiasm, and my perspective as a native Californian. I think a lot of people, Drew, are just demoralized. I talked to these developers I told you about, and one of them I called, I heard he was a very, very wealthy guy. And the largest individual maximum contribution you give is $34,200. You can't win without a lot of people maxing out. So I called this guy, and he didn't know who I was. So I told him briefly. And I told him some of my ideas. And he goes, well, you know, it's CEQA. And I told him one of the things, the first thing I'm going to do is enact my emergency powers, and I'm going to suspend CEQA so that builders will be encouraged to build. And all of a sudden, he sparked up. And I've had that kind of mood swing over and over and over again when I call these high-end people. They're just, they've given up. And I said, aren't you tired of losing? Don't you want somebody like me from the hood who was raised in Pico Union, a heavily Hispanic area? It still is. And my dad had his restaurant there for years and years and years. And when my dad left the restaurant, Drew, he'd walk out with his bag of cash. And these guys, some of them are gangbangers, are sitting on his car. My dad hands him the bag of cash. My dad opens the trunk, they hand him the back of the bag of the cash. He puts it in there and drives away. They were protecting him because we were on that block since 1950. And my dad, when he started the little cafe there, would give these little kids ice cream for free. And they grew up and they remember it. And so my dad had all this goodwill. Don't you want somebody from California who's born and raised here, who's seen the decline, who can turn this thing around? And all of a sudden they perk up. They're demoralized. Yeah. We have not had a person to win statewide in California, as I mentioned, true conservative since Bill Jones, Secretary of State. I don't count Arnold Schwarzenegger. They're demoralized. And some of the people who are independents and Democrats, many of them signed this petition to have this man recalled. 2.2 million people signed it. We only needed 1.6. Around 25% or so of the ones signing were independents and Democrats who voted for this guy just 2 years ago. They've had it. So I just don't think people have explained things in a way that the average person can get. And I don't think people have explained ideas and solutions that the average people can get because they've been too busy packing up, going to Tennessee and going to Florida.
I've only got a minute left. Very briefly, can you overcome the bias of the press? It's such a powerful leftist force. Can you overcome that?
It is a huge, huge force. I'm born and raised in L.A. The L.A. Times has never reviewed any of my half dozen books, even though two of them made the L.A. Times bestseller list. My movie, Uncle Tom, that came out Juneteenth last year, made more money than all five of the movies that were nominated for Best Oscar combined documentary. I had a higher IMDb rating than any of them. LA Times did not review any of them. I just got trashed by a female reporter in the LA Times recently. However, George Skelton, the dean of reporters, LA Times, he said there is a path for Elder to win. I was shocked because this guy is kind of jaded. He's almost 80 years old. He's seen it all, said it all, and he says Elder can win. So I've turned these journalists around. I've asked them often before I even start the interview, when's the last time you voted for a Republican? Well, I said, you think you're going to be fair to me? Well, and I said, we're off the record. Does that still count? And I've interviewed them, not pushing them around, but I asked a few questions. And I think I've made them a little more likely to be fair. And yeah. I've been impressed with some of the people who've written articles about me in the last week or so, where I thought at first they were going to be biased. I had a little conversation with them before we start the interview, and I think they're on guard to be a little more fair than they normally are. So I'm not worried. I think the average person, understands what's going on with crime, with homelessness, with the arrogant way he slammed down this the state because of the coronavirus and the high cost of living. And I've got some ideas, and I think I can make the case.
You know, Larry, I got to go. But before I do, I got to tell you, that film Uncle Tom was absolutely fantastic. I meant to write you about it. I talked about it on the show. Just a great, great job. And the second thing I want to tell you is I hope you win this thing, buddy. I really do. I would love to see you become governor of California. It's great to see you.
But thank you. Give a little love to Justin Malone. He directed the film, and it was a Malone film. I just executive produced it, raised the money, had a small hand in writing it. So give a little love to Justin Malone.
Excellent job. Good luck, buddy.
Thank you.
All right. That's you. Thank you. All right. That bittersweet time has arrived when you gather your familiar problems around you and bid them farewell, because we're going to solve them all right here on The Mailbag.
We will overcome someday.
Yeah! That was just depressing. I'm sorry. All right, this one is from Paul. Dearest Klavan, ruler of the multiverse. I don't want to correct you, but it's actually Klavan, dearest ruler of the multiverse. Last week, you announced that you have played a big part in a show about the Bible. Yes, this is a script I've written for a Bible, an Old Testament show that we're trying to raise money for. If you want to go to investinkayo.tv, you can invest, but please read the specs because it's an investment. You can lose your money. So you want to know what you're getting into. But if you want to support this project I'm doing about the Bible. So he says, Paul says, I've also noticed that you have been spending more time discussing Christianity on your show. I was a Christian for 20 years, and I understand the positive influence Christianity has had on American values. But as someone who is no longer a Christian, I feel not only alienated by your talking about it, but it also makes your show less interesting to me. I'm wondering if you have any projects in the works that will be interesting and exciting to people like me who aren't looking for overtly Christian forms of entertainment. Thank you for the work that you do on your show. You are the best host at the Daily Wire. That's just an obvious truth. Hashtag came for Ben, stayed for Klavan. You know, really interesting question, Paul, and I'm happy to get a chance to answer it. Yes, there are things that I write that don't have overtly Christian ideas in them. I have a book that actually, a book that is about, that's a Christmas book, but is not a religious book. It's a mystery story. However, the reason I talk about God and specifically a Christian God is because nothing I say makes sense without him. The defense of your, and I'll go even further and really insult you here, Paul. Nothing you say makes sense without him either. The idea of freedom doesn't make sense without God. The idea of morality doesn't make sense without God. You cannot find a path to moral thought. You know, last week there were some questions in the mailbag where I had pointed out why you can't find a path to moral objectivity without an idea of God. And people will say, well, couldn't it just be, you know, that our human feeling, our common sense? Well, no, because the question is, why would you do anything for anybody else if you did not feel that somehow that was written at a moral, what we call a supernatural level, a level above nature, where your actions, your natural actions, like giving a beggar bread, as opposed to torturing a child, those natural actions have a supernatural moral meaning. And in order to get to that place, and believe me, I tried for 49 years to think my way out of it. To get to that place, you have to believe in some sort of God who looks very much like the Christian God. So I don't like to talk nonsense. I don't like to talk without making sense. And that's why I say the things I say, and that's why I return to these ideas. I know it's alienating to some people. I understand that it's alienating to some people. And I'm not telling anybody what they have to believe, and I'm not even preaching. I'm not even telling you that this is what you should believe. But what I do say, and I say this as an objective, logical truth, is that you cannot create a moral system without a God, and you can't create a system in which your freedom is inviolable without a God. There's a reason that God is mentioned in the Declaration of Independence. I wrote in this an article for American Mind just this week called The Axiomatic God of Freedom, where I say, you know, the reason they said that it is self-evident truth that you are given rights by your creator. You are endowed with rights by your creator. Self-evident there doesn't mean it's obvious. If it were obvious, it wouldn't have taken thousands of years for people to notice them. Self-evident, it means that you cannot, it means axiomatic. You cannot get to freedom. You cannot get to rights without there have there being a creator who endowed you with them. So that's why I do it. I talk like that because I want to make sense. I talk like that because if you don't make sense, if you don't understand where your ideas are founded, what is the basis, the self-evident basis of your ideas, when people attack your ideas, when people attack your freedom, you won't be able to defend them. And I see this all the time. I saw it in the 60s when people started to attack freedom and started to attack Americanism. And the people who were supporting Americanism and supporting beauty in the arts and supporting objective morality didn't have any arguments for them because they'd given up the argument of God. They'd allowed people to take God out of the schools. They'd allowed people to make God an impolite thing to talk about. It's not nice to talk about God. It's impressive. You know, you have to be able to argue logically without God. There's some things you can't argue logically without. You have to have a basis, an illogical basis. Even if you're a mathematician, even math has an illogical basis, an unprovable basis. So does freedom, so does morality. And that's why I talk about it, because I want to make sense. And I think you should want to make sense, too. And I can't let you off the hook for that, even though I know it does alienate people. From David: Dear Klavan, master of the balding verse, wizard of wordery, and the dubbed sexy Gandalf. I'm a young man nearing my mid-20s, and I have come seeking advice in matters of the heart. For nearly a decade, I've been in love with a young woman. We'll call her B. We dated for 2 years back when I was in high school, and she left me after I moved to college, nearly half the state away, because she couldn't deal with a long-distance relationship. She's a little bit younger. He's basically been unable to get over her. He says, over the past 2 years, my prayers have drifted towards, as my mind has been terming it, that these cursed feelings, which I cannot budge, be lifted from me, that I may follow God's guidance in finding a lasting relationship. I'm now at a point where I can honestly say that I harbor very little negative feelings toward what used to be. However, the more the negativity has loosened its grip on me, the more my love for B has welled up in my heart again. Like every passing day, my feelings for B get stronger. I want to reach out to her and establish contact again, but at the same time, part of me thinks it's a terrible idea. I'm wondering what you make of this. God bless you. From David. You know, I don't believe this is about this woman at all, to be honest with you. I don't think you're in love with her. I don't think you're in love with what used to be. I think that you have suffered an ego blow and you are not acting like a man and getting over it. When she left you, when she broke up with you, it was a tremendous blow to your pride and to your ego. And you want to heal that pride by going back and getting it right this time. That's not the way to manhood. That's not the way to love. That's not the way into the future. The way into the future is to accept and feel the blow. Is to feel, oh yeah, I'm in pain from this rejection, and to thereby walk through that pain into a new future where you can go to someone else. I mean, you don't cling to a woman like this because you're like this, who's already left you and who's been gone for 10 years, because you love her. You do it because you love something about yourself that you feel she injured. And I think that that's a mistake. And I think you're making that mistake. And I think you're going to have to let it go, which is tough. Do I have time for one more? One more from Doug. Lord Klavan, I'm seeking advice. I feel that my work and consequently my life has little to no meaning. I have a beautiful wife, a 7-month-old daughter, a dog, and a mortgage. I live in an area that is great in a relatively good school district. My life looks good, but I feel all the work I do has little meaning. I'm in sales. I sell things to people they generally have to save for, but that doesn't give me any satisfaction. They're luxury goods. I would like to get involved in public life or something related to it. However, I don't have a college degree and get passed over relatively quickly because of that fact. I have many skills and I'm well-read. Unless reading Knowles' book takes books away from my account, it does detract, but it doesn't detract all of them. It's not that good. I'm not sure where to take my life. I'm eager and willing to work. I would just like the opportunity to do work that has meaning. Yeah, and I think you should. First of all, I think you should pause for a minute and be grateful for your beautiful wife and your beautiful daughter. You sent a picture of your daughter, and she is beautiful, for your dog and your mortgage. All those things are things to be grateful for. You built them. You created that life for yourself with their help. And I think that that's a beautiful thing. And that should have meaning in and of itself. And it's possible that you should be using this time to develop the skills you need to have a more meaningful life. It's possible you need to stay with your job for now and work to support your family. But that in staying with your job, you are giving yourself time to get ready, maybe to get a higher degree, but maybe you don't need a higher degree. Maybe you just need to learn the things that you need to learn to get the kind of work that you want. First, you have to decide what that work is. Then you have to decide what the qualifications you need to do that work are, and then you have to get those qualifications, and that may take you some time, but you should definitely commit yourself to that. You want your life to have meaning. You want your work to have meaning. Guys are all about their work, and you should want your work to have meaning in your life. So get to work. Work a little harder. Stay up a little later. Get a little less sleep, and do the things you need to do to prepare for a life with more meaning. There's nothing unreasonable about what you're saying. You just have to do the work that you need to do to get there. And good luck. I'm going to stop there. So none of this really matters because it's the Clavenless week is upon you and you will probably be destroyed simply by your own despair. The wailing, the gnashing of teeth, the darkness, the flames. I don't even like to think about it. However, if you survive, if you crawl your way through this apocalyptic disaster to next Friday, I will be here with the Andrew Klavan Show and I will still be Andrew Klavan. Hey, if you enjoyed this episode and want to spread the word, give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe, too. We're available on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, basically wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, remember to check out the other Daily Wire podcasts, including The Ben Shapiro Show, The Matt Walsh Show, and The Michael Knoll Show. Thanks for listening. The Andrew Klavan Show is produced by Mathis Glover. Executive producer, Jeremy Boring. Our technical director is Austin Stevens. Production manager, Pavel Vidowski. Edited by Danny D'Amico. Lead audio mixer, Mike Cormina. Animations are by Cynthia Angulo. Production coordinator, McKenna Waters. And our production assistant is Jacob Falash. The Andrew Klavan Show is a Daily Wire production. Copyright Daily Wire 2021.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs compares Trump supporters to Nazis. New reports out of Georgia raise serious questions about the 2020 presidential election, and a huge swath of Americans wants to secede. Check it out on The Michael Knoll Show.
Escape to Ocean City, Maryland, and discover a place that just feels lighter, where every day feels like Saturday, and French fries are a food group, where flip-flops are always in fashion, and seafood is always in season, where the boardwalk is bustling and the beach is right outside your door, where you can rise with the tide and feel like a kid again. Ocean City, Maryland, somewhere to smile about. Book your trip at oceocean.com.